This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Stephanie Powell Watts is among the many writers who have long admired The Great Gatsby. As a young reader, she was fascinated with the novel's love story, but as she got older, she began thinking more deeply about the other themes, nostalgia and desire. In her debut novel, Stephanie has channeled parts of The Great Gatsby into a story about an African-American family living in small-town North Carolina. The book is called No One Is Coming to Save Us. Stephanie reads in Raleigh, Durham, and Asheville next week. We've got that information on our website. But first, Stephanie Powell Watts joins us live on our program. Hello, Stephanie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. This is in no way a rewrite of The Great Gatsby. It is its own book in its own wonderful voice. But you have said that it was inspired by The Great Gatsby. How so?
It's definitely inspired by Gatsby. It started at a very different place, but once I started writing it a couple years into the process, I started thinking about how concerned I was about home and where do you find home and how do you find it. And that became the kind of theme for the characters that I was writing. And I love in Gatsby how the characters are all striving, they're all longing, and I wanted that element in my book too.
Well, tell us about your story. It begins with a family who has lost a son. Tell us more about your story.
Well, my story there focuses on the women. Gatsby, as you know, has a male narrator, Nick Carraway, and of course Gatsby, and it focuses on their stories. And so that's one of the things that I really wanted to remedy in my book, to hear about the women that were left behind or that chose to stay. And so two women are at the heart of my story. Sylvia Ross is about 70 years old, and her daughter, Ava, who is about 40. They live in rural North Carolina. They have many of the challenges of life, not enough money, difficult husbands, past that won't stay in the past. And both women are really consumed by separate desires that they can't fulfill. Into this setting.
Keep going. Yeah, no, go ahead.
In this setting returns my Gatsby character, J.J. Ferguson, who years ago was a lonely kid, and now he's come back and he's middle class and he's still a longing adult, and he is intent on convincing Ava, his old friend, to love him again, and he wants to find family. That's his main purpose.
And he thinks building this home may be the way to do this in a particular place in your fictional town of Pinewood. I wonder if you'd read for us from the opening of the book.
Oh, sure. The house he's building is done mostly. All that's missing now is the prettying, stain on the sprawling deck, final finishing inside. At least that's what they say. This house has been the talk around our small town. Not much happens here, but the same, same. A 13-year-old girl waiting for the baby her mother's sorry boyfriend gave her. The husband we wanted to believe was one of the good ones, found out to be the worst kind of cheater with a whole other family two towns over. The same stupid surprises, the usual sadnesses. But this thing is strange. The boy we all saw grow up came back to us, slim and hungry gaunt, like a coal miner, with money. J.J. Ferguson made it. The poor child who lived with his grandmother, dead for years now, the ordinary boy we all fed when he wouldn't leave at dinner time, looking like he was waiting for somebody to ask him to play. We had no idea. J.J. was the newest resident on Brushy Mountain Road. The car they say is his was parked on the long driveway most mornings, until evening, while J.J. worked alongside the Mexican men he'd hired. Every town has a section where the people are rich and their lives so far from yours, you almost expect them to speak another tongue. Brushy Mountain Road is that place for us. You can't help but get quiet driving on the road, like your noisy breathing might disturb the beauty or rupture the holy calm that order and clean create. When we were young, we used to love to see the houses, all lit up with curtains and blinds open, glowing yellow like sails in the black faraway of the ocean. If we went slow enough, we could see the brilliant colors of the decorated rooms, their floor-to-ceiling bookcases, fine furniture, floral designs with wallpaper you couldn't get at the regular hardware store. We might even get a glimpse of one of them, sipping from a mug or snuggled into a chair staring out into the darkness. Though we knew they lived among us, bought white bread and radial tires like the rest of us, we loved the proof of them. I see him with my own eyes. We breathed in the houses, dreamed about the ones that would have been ours if our lives had run in different directions, if we'd had different faces, if we'd made all the right choices.
Stephanie Powell Watts reading from her new novel, No One Is Coming to Save Us. She's going to be reading across the state in coming days, and you can check our website for those readings. I think you set up beautifully here some of these themes of desire and envy and the way they trap us in this kind of eternal suffering. So set up this environment for us and the culture in these small towns that you create for us.
I really wanted to focus on the women, as I mentioned, and also staying and what that means to be home for someone. And sometimes we think of the adventurer or the one who has the grit is the one who packs up and gets a family and moves to some other part of the world or some other part of the United States. And as I'm sure you know, the great migration of African Americans in the last century went on for decades. And we look to those people as these great adventurers, and they were, and they had incredible obstacles. But the ones who stayed behind also are worthy of our attention and our focus, and they were also brave to do that, to imagine that the world was going to be better and that the place that they called home, that they could make it home if they just stayed there and worked hard enough to do that.
There was always some better, though, some way of achieving something that was beyond what they had in the moment. And that's part mm-hmm. of what's, I think, what's animating some of your characters in this book. Certainly the desire to stay home and retain what they had, but also make it better, not just live in it in its current circumstance.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And my characters, they all have this desire that they can't put down. You know, they want the American dream, and they realize that they're in the cheap seats of the American dream, but they still want it, and they're fighting all the time these ghosts of the furniture industry. My novel is set in the foothills area of North Carolina, and so they've all been impacted by the loss of that industry, and ghosts of segregation and Jim Crow, ghosts of their that are personal, that are of their own family and of loss. So they're all being impacted by that, but still they want things. They're really trying hard to see what they have access to and trying to get those things in their lives.
And you grew up in Lenore, North Carolina, in those very foothills. So I'm sure that in many ways influenced your fictional Pinewood.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I remember very fondly the Lenore, Wilkesboro, those areas where I grew up. I remember when the McDonald's opened in Lenore. What a huge
deal that was.
It was fantastic. I mean, people were lined up around the corner to go to McDonald's, you know, and we used to go. It was a special treat for us. Every Friday we would go and have one of those, you know, little burgers. That was a big deal, you know.
Tell us, were they 15 cents back then? That's what I remember. I remember the 15-cent McDonald burger. That's how far back I go. Tell us about the relationship of mother and daughter here, Sylvia and Ava.
They have a great relationship. It is tumultuous, and in my book, it's the start of where they're starting to kind of pull away from each other. There's a generational divide, and also there are these ideas about expectations, what you want in your life and what you can expect to get. And Sylvia has her own ideas about that. And of course, they're shaped by her environment, by the things that she's seen with her own mother and those kinds of things. But Ava really wants more, and she wants to figure out how to get it. And so they're for the first time, they're having they're kind of butting heads. They didn't win when Ava was a teenager, when you might expect that. But now they are when she's entering middle age. Mm-hmm. They're starting to have these problems.
Well, maybe I could get you to read another passage that talks about Sylvia's experience in Pinewood and maybe ask you to set it up for us.
Oh, sure. Sylvia is she has a sister, Lana, and she has just gone to visit her after just visiting J.J. Ferguson, his new home. And instead of making her feel fantastic, instead of it being an elation, it's really kind of put her in a melancholy place. One, because there's something that he achieved that was impossible for her. And so that's part of it. And it also just makes her remember the past that she can't fix. And part of that past is about her mother. The past had started erasing behind Sylvia like in a cartoon. Her life as a girl, the lives of her parents, her son, all disappearing as if they had never been. Giving up the pain and exclusion had meant also losing years of her life. The trick was cutting out the bad like a tumor, hoping the nasty had not spread into the rest of her thinking, cutting it out, but somehow managing to survive. Isn't that always the trick? In a small town, your dead mother haunts nearly every corner, turning up in 1,000 places you don't expect. At first, she scared you, her face, her smell, a memory of her at the laundromat, at the post office. But soon you delighted in her presence. You remembered her kind moments and her happiness. But in time, as the years progressed, you recalled her in the meat of her life, in her ordinary days, the way she normally existed. You remembered her anger, ever ready, that gripped her like a lifeline. You remembered her ability to ignore you, her pleading child, ignore you and your pain completely.
Stephanie Powell Watts reading from her debut novel, No One Is Coming to Save Us. She's reading across the state of North Carolina, and we've got information at her website, stateofthings.org. Tell us about the title, No One Is Coming to Save Us.
When I first proposed this title to my editor, I came up with it several years ago, and I really liked it. And I proposed it to my editor, and she was, oh, I'm not sure. No, mm-hmm. I think she was afraid people might think it was depressing or that it was just that was defeatist or apocalyptic even. And I just didn't see it that way at all. There's this moment in your life, and everybody has them, when you feel like, it's just me and nobody else is coming. And, you know, I've had these moments. I've had them for good and for ill. Many of us in the country had them after the last election. And you just feel heartsick. You feel defeated. And you take that moment and you wallow in it and you binge watch Columbo or whatever. And, you know, and then you say, okay, what's my next step? Let me get my hat. Let me take it to the street. Let me do the thing that I have to do to move on to the next phase. And so I think of the title as that galvanizing moment, like, oh my goodness, nobody's coming. It's got to be me. And so I hope that people, when people read it, that they see some of that.
Well, there is something about these relationships that is redemptive and, in a sense, uplifting, very much so, even in the desperation of their aspiration and their hopeless reconstituting of the past and trying to make it all better. There's a certain amount of suffering and sort of not being where you are, and yet there's redemption in the relationships themselves. And I think that's how it, for me, how it differs greatly from Gatsby, which ends up being a cautionary tale, more prescient than perhaps Fitzgerald even knew, about a nation that disdains the present so much and is constantly living in a past that never was and a future that never will be. He got that. And to some extent, the relationships in here, I think, are more powerful and redeeming. Is that something that you had in mind or just evolved as you wrote the book?
Oh, thank you so much. No, it was an ongoing process, and I was really interested in this whole idea about nostalgia. And I mean, I find myself in those places too, thinking about my own childhood and thinking about some of the things that shaped me, that were difficult. And, you know, I find that nostalgic impulse comes in and I want to make it about the beautiful setting or about being with my four younger brothers, you know, that kind of thing. And there were those moments and those were true and they absolutely should be part of the memory. But if I forget those other more difficult moments, then it doesn't do justice to the story. And so I think I think Fitzgerald was trying to tell a story about nostalgia, and as you say, a cautionary one. But I think he was saying if we can't live in the present, if we can't do it and move forward, then we're doomed the way the characters are. Then our lives stop at this moment. And so if we can figure out how to move forward and not live in this nostalgic place, that's a good place that feels good, but only for a moment. Right. If we can't, then we're in stasis, and that's no good for anybody.
Tell us about another major difference in this book, of course, is, well, the poetry. I think the poetic language in this book is absolutely wonderful. And you also have shifting points of view. This isn't told from just one point of view. Tell us about that decision.
I wanted this to be a kind of communal voice, and the book starts with this communal voice and then shifts into different different points of view into different people's heads and in their thinking, because I wanted to center it around the women and let their story be the prominent stories in the book. But I also wanted to be able to move around to other people in the community. I wanted the community to have a say. I think that Fitzgerald was doing something like that with the Nick Carraway character. He didn't want to focus it on Gatsby. He wanted to see, well, what do other people think about this? How are other people perceiving and understanding this story? And that's the kind of move I wanted to do too.
This has been a tremendous success, critical, and I think a growing popular success. What's next for you?
Oh well, I'm starting another book. It's actually set in Winston-Salem.
So you just can't leave North Carolina. You're trying to leave, but you can't. You
want
to?
That's exactly right.
Set in Winston-Salem.
Uh huh. Yeah, it is.
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll have you back.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a thrill.
Stephanie Powell Watts. Her new novel is called No One Is Coming to Save Us. She's going to read Tuesday at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, Wednesday at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, Thursday Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. All of that is at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Laura Pelliser, Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.